Welcome back to another episode of The Political Life. Today, we have Megan Price. Megan Price of the Center for Applied Insight Conflict Resolution. Did I get that right?
You sure did.
All right. Megan came to us via Michael O'Brien, who has been a guest on the show. And Megan, we're so excited to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Megan, tell our listeners, tell our listeners about your organization.
Okay. So the Center for Applied Insight Conflict Resolution is based in Washington, D.C. And really what we do is we apply the insight approach to conflict analysis and resolution to problems out in the world, mostly problems that arise because of conflict. And so our main project is insight policing, which helps to prepare officers with skills that allows them to manage conflict effectively, really communicate through conflict in difficult encounters with the public.
And when did you start the organization?
2016.
Okay. And you've had a busy and intense, that's some, you know, what 5-6 years doing this?
Yeah.
And what was the inspiration for you? Where did you get the, because you started this, so where did you get the idea? Do you remember when you first had the idea that, boy, I should really, that police officers and other in law enforcement type roles need to learn or be exposed to conflict resolution type of approaches, new approaches? When did you first have that idea? And do you remember that?
Yeah, well, the idea really came in 2011, which is when we colleagues and I at George Mason University, I was a PhD student at the time, we had the opportunity to apply for a grant from the Department of Justice to see how conflict resolution principles and ideas might have an impact on the problem of retaliatory crime in cities across America.
And what is retaliatory crime?
So retaliatory crime, retaliatory violence is when there's conflict between two people and it becomes violent to the extent that it's criminal. So, shootings, stabbings, robberies between people who know each other in order to get back at one another to kind of have justice.
And so how do you get hired or who pays for your services?
So public agencies, law enforcement agencies, or, you know, even various private organizations call us and hire us. But law enforcement agencies really leverage federal and state money to hire us. So they can request insight policing kind of services through a number of mechanisms, and money comes from the Department of Justice ultimately.
And so if a police operation in a certain city or town hires you for insight policing, kind of walk us through the process. So they hire you, you begin to engage, and how do you do that?
Oh, okay. So it can happen in a number of ways, but one way how it's happening now, which is pretty wonderful, is last year, the Community-Oriented Policing Office of the Department of Justice, the COPS office, established a handful of national de-escalation training coordinators throughout the country, pretty much as in response to George Floyd, to, you know, this push for reform, for officers learning how to de-escalate as an important skill set. So agencies can request insight policing through the National De-escalation Training Coordinator. There are also a couple of other mechanisms that COPS office funds where you can access insight policing. And the National De-escalation Training Coordinator gets in touch with us and provides the funding for us to go out to wherever and train a 2-day course. So insight policing skills are trained through a 2-day course. It's based on, you know, the first the first half of the day of the first day is really theory, kind of how to, really understanding how we use our minds in conflict. And then the rest of the day, the rest of that day and the next day are all skills. So we do drills, we do scenarios, we do practice so that by the time an officer has finished those 2 days of training, they're ready to go out onto the street and really recognize conflict in interactions and use strategic communication skills to understand what's going on so they can leverage their own problem solving skills to come to a solution that can generate voluntary compliance. So there's a 2-day class. And then after that, we offer learning supports to make sure that, you know, officers stay sharp in their skills. And we try to, you know, maintain connections with agencies and offer, you know, refresher courses and that kind of thing, just to, because these skills are fundamental in policing. And it's really only becoming clear to law enforcement in general that in order to meet their targets, to be effective, to solve crime, keep community safe, and also maintain trust, they need to have a solid, strong foundation of communication skills, particularly ones that they can leverage in interactions that are difficult or have the potential to escalate.
And have you done any what are known as ride-alongs to see the police? And is that helpful to you to be like, you see actual situations developing and you can use that as an example as to what they could have done or not do? Or
Yeah. I mean, I've definitely done a number of ride-alongs and it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting to see the diversity of interactions that a police officer has every single day. And they're not all fraught, you know,
right.
A lot of them go really, really smoothly. And then, you know, you do see, you know, I've done ride-alongs here in Washington and, you know, officers also see a lot of, hard stuff, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of normal interactions and then a lot of stressful interactions.
Yeah.
And it's kind of hard to know probably which kind of interaction they're going into. What, and then how do you, you obviously have instructors or people that you work with. How do you select, what kind of training do the people have that you work with that you bring in to do the 2-day seminars?
So everyone who I train with, has a law enforcement background. So most of them are veteran law enforcement, either retired or currently active. So we have a week long instructor training course. And so instructors go through that training course to really understand how to deliver the material. And they have to have a commitment to policing the community well. Right. Mm-hmm. And that means humanizing them and respecting everyone, even if they've done something wrong.
And what changes have you seen since you began doing this up until today? Any obvious changes or that you've seen?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, we started this and so we got the grant. We applied for the grant in 2011, which launched Insight Policing. We did a year of research. So that was 2012. And then 2013 was really when we piloted the program. And so that was both in Memphis and in Lowell. And then I actually reformulated Insight Policing for the school context. And I did for my dissertation research. And I worked with school staff. So mostly behavioral staff. So the principal, vice principal, you know, dean of students, those folks in a local DC charter high school, to address the problem of the school to prison pipeline, right? So, exclusionary discipline, because there are a lot of parallels between criminal behavior, right? Where if you violate a rule violate a law, ultimately there's a particular consequence, right? You get a ticket or you get arrested or whatever it is. In school, if you break a rule, you get suspended or detention or expelled. So there's kind of a set consequence. What we know from, you know, the criminal justice system that often an arrest isn't really going, that kind of consequence isn't necessarily going to change behavior. Similarly in schools, that kind of exclusionary discipline doesn't address the problem, right? It kind of leverages fear or threat to hope that, that kind of consequence will change behavior, but it doesn't work very well. So I reformulated the training for school staff and had to condense it. So we started with a 40-hour training and I condensed it to, I believe about 3 days, the equivalent, with school staff. And then I reformulated again after 2016, what was the end of 2017, for police again in this very condensed form. So it became a 2-day training. And when I began rolling it out, you know, anew in 2017, there was a lot of, so people weren't really resistant to the training once they got into it, but they were resistant to, the idea that, so there were two main hangups, I guess. The first being that nobody has time to talk, right? So officers are always constrained by time. There's this sense where they've got, you know, the calls are building up. They've got to, you know, get from one place to another and nobody's got time. You have to do what I say or else. Kind of ask, tell, make culture, where if, you know, if I can't get this done quickly, then I'm going to have to use the tools on my belt to make you comply. And that's just the way it is. And there was a sense that that was required because of time constraints and also for safety, right? So you have to exert power kind of in that kind of a way. And so in 2017, that was still very much ingrained. And I play this video, I still do, of a Baltimore police officer doing an incredible job getting a man who is out on the street with a knife, getting the man to drop the knife, to hand over the knife, right, and stop being this kind of public threat. And he uses, without knowing it, skills that align with insight policing, which are really very much around getting curious about where somebody is coming from in their resistance, aggression, noncompliance. They're the decisions that they're making that are making the encounter challenging. So this officer, Officer V, he asks, you know, he says, okay, why can't you drop the knife? You know, why can't we sit down right now and talk about it? And in 2017, I got so many criticisms for, and ultimately after asking these questions, the subject hands over the knife, puts his hands behind his back without any kind of resistance. And, you know, it doesn't end in violence. This is the kind of situation that we would see right now on YouTube, you know, and there would be harm. So this Officer V does an amazing job. And I would play it as an example of how questions are so powerful in a conflict encounter. And officers would call me out saying, this is really irresponsible. This might have happened once, but the man had a knife. The officer was probably 20 feet away, but he had to get closer in order to retrieve the knife. And yeah, there was a lot of kind of dissent around this video. Now, 2023, people see this video and they say, I want to be that officer. I want to be able to use my communication skills in a way that leads to an outcome like that. So there was resistance 5-6 years ago, whereas now this is really how officers who I work with want to be trained.
Wow. Very interesting. And so what you teach in this conflict resolution is by engaging with the person and asking questions, the officer can de-escalate the situation to the point where the person actually puts down the knife. And so no one gets shot, no one gets tased, there's no violence. Yeah. And my guess is at the same time, you can teach the officer can remain a safe distance while they engage with people and ask questions and not put themselves at risk. That's very interesting, and interesting the different view of that encounter today versus 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so is that a lot of what you teach, how to teach these officers how to engage with people through questions, through dialogue? Is that one of the primary ways, or maybe the only way, that they work to de-escalate it?
Yeah. So in a lot of ways, insight policing is both fundamental and advanced. So there are pieces that officers learn in other de-escalation trainings that are important, like maintaining a calm tone, you know, not getting pulled in, explaining where you're coming from, you know, being transparent yourself about the stop. So those are very basic, important ways to, you know, interact or communicate with a community member. What insight policing does is goes right into the conflict encounter. And so what we teach officers is first to recognize conflict behavior in the moment, because when we're faced with people who aren't doing what we ask, you know, who are, you know, yelling at us or mad or angry, right? And we're an officer and we're just trying to do our jobs. It's easy, it's very easy for us to find to react in kind, right? So you're not doing what I say. Well, you know, screw you. I'm going to make you do what I say, you know, so it becomes an escalated encounter. It becomes conflict interaction. So before it can actually become a conflict interaction, we teach officers to recognize those kinds of behaviors as conflict behaviors. And conflict behaviors are produced through a particular type of decision, which is really a decision to defend in response to a feeling of threat. And so the threat isn't just a physical threat, right? It's a threat to something I care about, or, you know, maybe my reputation or the way that I think things should work. Something that matters is at stake. And so I'm defending, and my defensive response looks like resistance, aggression, noncompliance, running away, you know, acting crazy, behaviors that are difficult for an officer to control. So what we do is say, first, before getting pulled into that behavior or, you know, using your own power to try to stop it, because really that's just going to be interpreted as a further threat and is going to escalate the situation, recognize it as conflict behavior and acknowledge that it's happening. That's the really the number one step. So I can see you're upset, or so you don't want to give me your ID. You're not comfortable, you know, talking to me right now. Reflect back to the person what they're giving you rather than getting pulled in, and then start to get curious. Okay, so what's upsetting you, or what are you worried is going to happen if you give me your ID, right? So you really, so what we teach officers is that decision-making process and how there are kind of inlets into that decision-making process that will help them discover the motivation for the difficult behavior. I'm worried that if I give you my ID, you're not going to give it back to me because that happened to me, you know, last month, and then I'm not going to be able to get to my job or, you know, something like that. We don't actually know what motivates people until we ask. And so officers can, just by acknowledging, you already bring down the tension. By getting curious, you show that you are, that you want to hear and want to listen to the issue that matters a lot to the person who you're dealing with. Once you get that information, so you've opened dialogue, you know, started to build a conversational rapport, and by doing that, you actually discover information that can help you as the officer do the work you're there to do. Give the ticket, explain that, oh, I'm going to give it right back, or I don't even need to take it. I'll, you know, write the information down right here, whatever it might be. But so it allows the officer to kind of get control over a potentially escalating situation and use it to discover information that can actually help them do their job. And then the community member feels heard, attended to, cared for, you know, in a difficult encounter, and is far more likely to cooperate and comply. And so those are the interactions that we want to have over and over and over again to start to change the experience and expectation that community members have of police, and really the experience and expectation that most police officers, I'd say all police officers, want the community to have of them.
Boy, that's really, that is really quite interesting. And it's you, boy, you must be very busy these days, getting hired. I remember I was reading something about how one state was trying to, that in the past, the police, they were trying to add to their training, very similar type of what you're talking about here, that, you know, police are trained, you know, almost like a military, like a SWAT team, how to approach situations. Yet many of the situations they go into it's just what you're describing. They need, like, you know, they need to have training as to how to engage with people, how to understand situations, not all the time how to, you know, it's not a military type situation. It's more of a domestic type situation, and they need to have some training into how to engage with citizens on that level. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like that's exactly what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. And that's where conflict resolution as a field, the scholarship of conflict resolution, really comes into play. And that's different than, you know, other de-escalation programs, which tend to focus on the experiences of officers. So I'm Officer Megan, and I've had a 30-year career where I've been able to de-escalate and I've been able to engage. So let me share with you kind of the techniques that I've developed over my time. And that's can be very useful, but when it's grounded in kind of theory and the science of, you know, how we use our minds under threat, then we give officers a framework that they can use over and over and over again to really explain why what they're doing with their skills works and how they should work, you know, most of the time. So kind of imbuing that conflict resolution scholarship is something different, and I think something that makes it work.
And then do you find that when you get hired by a police department to come in and do some training, that they then incorporate it as part of their ongoing program?
Well, that's where we're kind of that's what we're working towards, and towards developing all of the supports that would be necessary for an agency to do that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so you got your PhD at George Mason?
I did.
Okay. And where'd you do your undergraduate work?
Reed College in Portland, Oregon.
Okay. And what did you study?
I studied history of religion.
Wow. So Megan, how did you go from the study of history of religion to this?
So I was always really fascinated with how religious worldviews, you know, impact the history. So, and also how much of conflict in the world has to do with a clash of worldview, right? And so if we could just understand where each other were coming from, then maybe we'd probably, you know, we'd be in a better place, or, you know, history would be very, very different. So there's this pattern of kind of misunderstanding leading to, yeah, violence and devastation and all that stuff. So I did that at Reed. And I studied kind of the apartheid protests, kind of the nonviolent South African end to apartheid. That was interesting. And then I got my master's in reconciliation studies in Northern Ireland. So I was still on this kind of path to understand, well, how can we just work better with one another? And so I thought reconciliation studies would be a good place to go. And Northern Ireland, with its history of conflict, would be a great place to do that. Mm-hmm. And I really was hoping that I would find the scholarship that would kind of chart a path forward, particularly for America. So this was in, I guess I started my master's in 2006, but we were still kind of war on terror, you know, wars in the Middle East. And it was just, I felt like we were kind of taking a wrong turn in a lot of ways. So I thought if I could go to grad school and understand what other people have thought up in terms of how to work together better, then I could contribute in some way. But what I found in terms of reconciliation studies is there were a lot of good ideas, but there were lots of recipes for how to heal, how to move past conflict. And it was like, oh, well, we need apology, we need reparation, we need this. And I doubted that. I said, well, really, does this recipe work every time for every context? I can't really see that. And so I was really interested in kind of rather than a recipe, I was looking for a method. How could we begin to think about conflict resolution, you know, moving forward past difficult situations in a way that could respond to the context at hand, right? A regular method that could be applied to the variety of conflicts that were in the world, or even in interpersonal relationships, right? But I doubted that we could use the same technique over and over again, or set of actions. So So I did that. I was kind of disappointed in the field because I saw all these recipes. And so I came back to America and I found a woman named Cheryl Picard in Ottawa, Canada, who had been working with a man named Ken Melchin to develop something called insight mediation. And so what was intriguing about insight mediation was that it leveraged curiosity to understand what was going on within a conflict and then basing interventions on what had been discovered. So it wasn't like, oh, you two are in conflict. It's an identity conflict. We're going to do X, Y, and Z. It's like, well, what is actually happening and how can we develop a response based on what's actually happening? So I got my graduate certificate in insight mediation from Carleton University and continued to think about the insight approach. So, and I really was less interested in mediation. That's not really what gets me going. It's more these big problems like criminal justice and, you know, sectarian conflict in Northern Ireland, those kinds of real ingrained, intractable social challenges. And so I started to dig into, well, how could the insight approach to mediation kind of be applied in a larger kind of social way? And I was interested in the conflicts in our backyard, right? This was 2009 or so is when I was applying for my PhD and I applied to Mason, and the focus was very international. You know, how can we, you know, intervene in Israel, Palestine? How can we, you know, work on these international conflicts? But statistics were coming out where, you know, 1 in 3 Black men were going to be in prison. And I thought, you know, what about the conflicts that we're facing right now? They might not be violent, outright violent, but there's a lot of structural violence going on in our own, in America that we aren't really paying attention to. And so that is why I wanted to understand how the insight approach could be expanded and applied to larger social conflicts, particularly American conflicts. And when we got this opportunity to apply for this grant from the Department of Justice, it just felt like absolutely the right thing.
So is the protocols that you were looking at before, like insight mediation, are those well-known approaches or protocols?
Yeah. It's a pretty well-known approach. I mean, it's all very new. I mean, 21st century. So Cheryl and Ken began developing, you know, articulating the insight approach like 2000. I think they started around 2001, but published in 2008. So, so it's all new and coming out of, again, theories and explanations that aren't context flexible. And so this idea that conflict is really a function of the decisions that we're making and that we can discover through targeted curiosity how we're making decisions in conflict, what is leading us to defend can give us a robust understanding of the challenges that we can then intervene in. So the way that this plays out in policing is just like that ID situation that I told you about. You know, when officers can understand, not assume why somebody is resisting or not complying or, you know, angry, right? And it's easy to assume because they see it all the time every day. But rather than assume, get curious and understand today at, you know, 9:16, this is what's happening for this person. Let me understand it so I can address it in the most targeted way that I possibly can.
I can't imagine how much time and effort it took for you to fully develop this insight policing approach. That must have taken years.
Yeah, it's taken a really long time. It's
taken a long time.
Yeah,
it's so fascinating. And really, I've just scratched the surface because, you know, hopefully it's not too obvious to the listeners that I really don't know much about any of this. But But you are educating us, which is very helpful. Now, were you, so you were actually in Northern Ireland? Were you there pre or post the Good Friday Agreement?
Post the Good Friday Agreement.
Okay.
I was there in 2006.
Okay.
Yeah.
And where were you studying there? Is that what you were doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was in Belfast, and I was at Trinity College Dublin in Belfast. So they have a cross-border program.
Okay.
In reconciliation.
And how was that?
It was amazing. It was wonderful. It was very, very interesting to be in Belfast then. And it was, yeah.
So the troubles were over and the Good Friday Agreement was in place. So mm-hmm. things were a little calmer, mm-hmm. probably, or a lot calmer. Yeah.
They were. Everybody was still kind of reeling. But there was definitely a new energy that you could feel where people were wanting something new and something different. Although I, you know, it's always two steps forward or one step forward, two steps. What is it? You step yeah. forward and you step back.
One step forward, two steps back. But it really, the Good Friday Agreement has been, you know, up until Brexit, has been incredible how well it has held together and reduced violence. Mm-hmm. It's just been incredible. Mm-hmm. So when you're doing your, how busy are you these days? Are you going from one city to the next? Can you do a lot of it on Zoom or how does that work?
Well, during the pandemic, we did everything virtually, which was actually a really great opportunity. I'm sure a lot of people felt the same way, but we pivoted very quickly and were able in 2020 to begin offering our courses online over Zoom, like so live, small class sizes, because it's really interactive as it's a skills-based mm-hmm. course. You have to really practice talking to people. Mm-hmm. And just last summer, we started doing in-person courses. So it's only been, you know, a handful of months that we've been back in person, but yeah, we're busy. I'm actually doing a Zoom training later today with bylaw officers in British Columbia and Alberta, Canada. So those are kind of code enforcement is our equivalent, but they have a lot of kind of low level bylaws is what they call them in municipalities all over Canada. Dog on leash, parking, you know, various construction permits, you know, directing traffic, those kinds of things that bylaw officers are responsible for rather than police officers. In America, I think, you know, police officers are kind of responsible for everything. But they're unarmed, they issue tickets, and they get a lot of resistance as one would expect. So being equipped with the skills to resolve conflict easily is useful for them. So.
Yeah, I
we're doing Zoom later.
Well, I bet in the U.S. When you were describing that, I was thinking of the parking ticket officers. Boy, they could probably use your services. Here in the U.S. Well, and Megan, for anybody listening, what's the best way for people to find you or track or find you on the web?
We have a website, insightpolicing.com.
Okay,
and that's best way.
Insightpolicing.com. Megan, it's been so great to have you on and learn about this. We wish you all the best. It's some very important work and you have given it just enormous thought and clearly in creating this whole insight policing approach. We appreciate you, you know, educating us a little bit about this today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Jim. It's been wonderful to be with you.
Yeah, it's been great. And for our listeners out there, remember you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and you can sign up for our email at thepoliticallife.net. And we will see you next week.